Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
It's Wednesday, the 17th of August. Good morning and welcome to this edition of Africa Link. I'm Isaac Mugabe, your host in Bonn, Germany. Coming up, in Zambia, more than 150 people are arrested following the announcement of President Edgar Lungu's election victory, which the opposition alleges was rigged.
The rigging was being done in our eyes. We saw what was happening. We know the anomalies.
We will also be going to South Africa, where 4 years ago, the nation was shocked by the police killings at the Marikana mine.
People mostly in that area do blame the government and the police for what happened and for little being done to improve their conditions since then.
Plus, a visit to the island of Lamu off the Kenyan coast. Stay tuned.
Top story.
In Zambia, police have arrested more than 150 people after riots broke out following the announcement of the results of last week's elections. President Edgar Lungu of the Patriotic Front was declared the winner, but the opposition UPND party has said it rejects the results and is expected to seek legal redress at the Constitutional Court. From Lusaka, Kathy Sikombi reports.
The day after the Electoral Commission of Zambia declared the ruling Patriotic Front the winner of last week's general elections, PF supporters filled the streets across the country to celebrate victory. But opposition UPND supporters also took to the streets, beating up President Lungu's supporters and destroying property worth thousands of dollars. Eyewitnesses confirmed that most parts of southern and western Zambia were affected and that riot police tried to disperse protesters with tear gas. Youths battled the police and chanted slogans like "Forward, Forward" and "We Want Change." Ray Hamonga, Zambia police spokesperson, gives an overview of the situation.
So far we have apprehended about a total number of 151 UPND or United Party for National Development party cadres that went amok and damaging property.
The UPND demands that somebody takes over the presidency in an acting capacity as soon as the petition against Lungu's re-election is filed and in accordance with the amended constitution. UPND Secretary General Stephen Katuka told DW that the opposition party will file the petition papers anytime this week. He added that the court has also granted leave for a start of judicial proceedings against the handling of the election.
The rigging was being done in our eyes. We saw what was happening. We know the anomalies. We tried to seek audience with the Electoral Commission of Zambia with a view that some of the concerns would be addressed, but they gave us a deaf ear.
Loveness Malambo is a victim of political violence and a member of the UPND. She was beaten and injured by PF supporters. She said PF cadres broke into the opposition party's main secretariat in Lusaka and got away with goods worth thousands of US dollars.
You know, this violence is making us sick, wanting to actually fight back because we have been restrained by our leaders as a party that violence should not be in our vocabulary. We should always speak peace. We should speak love.
DW tried to talk to PF Secretary General Davis Chama, but he refused to comment. Political analyst Boniface Chembe says it is important for the incoming Zambian president to unite the country before more lives are lost.
Once you are voted into office, you are a president for everybody, irrespective of whether people voted for you or not. And, you know, that's democracy. That is what democracy requires. And what is important right now is to ensure that those who have been elected into office are in a position to unite the nation. Ensure that this message that sometimes we have tended to hear from our political leaders, not feeling obliged to take development to areas that did not vote for them, is addressed and is addressed head on if we are to continue operating under the motto of One Zambia, One Nation.
The recent general elections have divided Zambian further along tribal lines. If the matter is not addressed quickly, it could plunge the country into chaos.
Kathy Sikombi reporting from Lusaka. The opposition UPND claims the election was rigged. But is there enough evidence to back up this allegation? A question I put to Knox Chitiyo, Associate Fellow with the Africa Program at Chatham House in the UK.
I think the UPND are going to find it difficult to prove electoral rigging. There's certainly concerns about the election process, which Hichilema and others have raised in terms of media access, in terms of there were, I think, some constituencies, Lusaka and one or two other constituencies, where there were issues around the counting of the votes. But I think for them to prove wholesale and systematic rigging, I think is going to be quite a tough task. I think we'll see as events unfold, but my gut feeling is that I think it's going to be hard for them to prove systematic and wholesale rigging, although, of course, as we've seen, there are concerns about some of the counting in some areas.
What do these arrests of opposition supporters tell us about the political environment in Zambia that has been known to be one of Africa's most stable democracies?
Well, I think it highlights really just how divided Zambia is. I mean, we've seen before the 2015 vote, again, was a very, very close vote, and there were incidents before, during, and after the election. So I think it shows just how politically divided Zambia is, because the voting, as we've seen, was done according to regional lines, with the Patriotic Front getting a lot of votes in the north and the east, and Hichilema's party getting a lot of support in the south and west. So I think for Zambia, even beyond this point, getting over that political regional divide in terms of voting is going to be an issue. And these arrests that we're seeing, I think, are of concern to the greater international community.
You just mentioned that the country is politically divided. Can the two work together as a gesture of reconciliation and uniting the country?
From the 2015 elections, I think there was some pressure put on both sides, both during and after the elections. You know, there was, for a few weeks, talk of a possible coalition government and so on and so forth. But I think the atmosphere, particularly this time around, has just been so confrontational between the two sides that it's going to be difficult to imagine a coalition government. But certainly both Lungu and Hichilema have, you know, they've got to calm things down, because otherwise, if the tensions between their supporters escalate, Zambia's growth has slowed down in recent years. So I think there will be pressure put from quietly on both men just to calm things down, especially with their supporters.
And who do you think will take the lead in exerting the pressure on the two leaders? Do you think SADC, that's where it should be coming in?
I think SADC certainly is talking to both of them, the African Union as well, and also probably the Western community as well, because this time around there were also their EU observers in place. The Commonwealth has been there. So I think there may be a concerted pressure from, you know, the global community behind the scenes on both men, because nobody wants this to escalate. Of course, now Hichilema has challenged the process, so it's going to go through the Constitutional Court. So it's going to be a rather protracted process, and nobody wants an escalation between the two parties while this post-election process is continuing.
Knox Chitiyo from Chatham House in the UK.
News, analysis, and feature reports. All that's here on Africa Link.
Now, 4 years ago, South Africa was shocked by the killing by police of 34 miners at the Marikana mine in the worst violence the country had experienced since the end of apartheid. Local media reported that hundreds of miners and Marikana residents have been commemorating those who died. Meanwhile, rights group Amnesty International has marked the anniversary by releasing a report in which it accuses the mine operator, Lone Mine, of failing to address the truly appalling living conditions of the miners, which contributed to the labor unrest in 2012. Gareth Newham is the head of the Governance, Crime and Justice Division at the Institute for Security Studies in Pretoria. My colleague Mark Codwell asked him why was it that so little had changed as far as the miners' living conditions were concerned.
I think the number of reasons, but one of them has been the reduction in mining activity in South Africa and the large numbers of miners that have been entrenched in recent years. So the profitability of his mines since the Marikana incident has happened has declined. In addition to reductions in profits, there's also been an issue of mines in South Africa not being held appropriately accountable to the conditions of their mining licenses, in which they promised to, for example, build houses and improve the lives of the communities that provide them with labor.
So is the South African government evading its responsibilities?
Well, some would argue that that is certainly the case. We have seen very little real progress made in terms of, for example, the government reaching a settlement with the victims of those that were killed or seriously injured in the massacre relating to civil claims against the state for loss of earnings and income. The presidency started negotiations only at the beginning of this year, and to date there's been no real progress made there. Only the National Commission of Police has been suspended for her role in the massacre, but no action has been taken against any other police official. So I think there hasn't been sufficient accountability for those involved.
So there's been no change in police procedures, and it could perhaps all happen again.
I don't think it will happen again. There certainly have been changes in policing, although not necessarily completely in line with the Marikana Commission report. For example, they've elevated the head of our public order policing unit in the South African Police Service to a major general, so it's a much more senior person who oversees operations. They've ensured that they're recruiting and training more officers so that they have sufficient public order policing officials to respond to large gatherings. You may recall that at Marikana, the public order policing officials, there weren't enough of them. So other units that were more tactical and more involved in high-risk policing were brought in, and they were the ones, in fact, that led to the shootings of 112 mine workers. It was not actually the public order policing units. And so there's been moves to try and bolster the capacity of the public order policing units so that there will not be a need to bring in untrained, high-risk units that are more likely to use lethal force. The police have also been a lot more cautious about using lethal force when it comes to large crowds. So I think, you know, in practice, there have been real changes since then. So there has been some movement, but it has been 4 years, and most of the recommendations have not seen very much movements to date.
The recent municipal elections in South Africa, the ANC suffered heavy losses. Have the miners changed their political allegiances in the last 4 years?
Yes, that was quite evident quite quickly after the massacre. We saw the National Union of Mine Workers, which is an affiliate to the Congress of South African Trade Unions, an alliance partner of the ruling African National Congress, collapsed in the Platinum Belt. Most of their supporters left and moved to an independent union, Association Union of Mine Workers and Construction Workers, AMCU. So that saw a big shift there and a big blow to the National Union of Mine Workers. And then we saw quite a big reduction in voting for the African National Congress in the municipalities around Marikana and Rustenburg area. So that certainly did have an impact on people's political insights and support. People mostly in that area do blame the government and the police for what happened and for little being done to improve their conditions since then.
Gareth Newham, Head of Governance, Crime and Justice Division at the Institute for Security Studies in Pretoria.
Behind the headlines.
And in case you've just joined us, this is DW's Africa Link program, straight from our studios here in Bonn. Welcome to the program. I'm Isaac Mugabe, your host. South Sudan says it is considering a plan by the United Nations to send more troops to its territory. The UN Security Council's authorization of 4,000 extra troops was in response to fierce fighting which erupted in South Sudan's capital Juba last month. Meanwhile, the enmity between political allies of President Salva Kiir and former Vice President Riek Machar continues unabated, as James Shimanyula reports for this week's Behind the Headlines.
It has been nearly 4 weeks since former Vice President Riek Machar left Juba and went into hiding. The political mood in the capital remains tense, and in recent days the government intensified its patrols of the streets. In the latest dispute between Machar's supporters and those of President Salva Kiir, the government decided to withdraw the passports of 6 opposition politicians who questioned Kiir's authority, among them Pagana Mum, former Secretary General of the ruling Sudan People's Liberation Movement, SPLM Party, and Majaka Dia Gott, former Defense Minister. The reason for the withdrawal, says Juba, was the call to place South Sudan under the temporary administration of the United Nations before fleeing South Sudan for the United States. Amum squarely blamed President Salva Kiir for plunging Africa's newest nation into the current political situation.
Alternative for South Sudan is international intervention to return it back to normalcy. The situation now is that you have tribal forces that are attempting to impose a tribalist hegemony in the country.
Angered by Amum's latest comments, Gordon Buai, spokesman at the South Sudan Embassy in Washington, hit back at him.
For these people calling for the UN to take over South Sudan and rule it for 5 years, this is a very serious crime. That is to topple the government of South Sudan and take it over so that South Sudan will be ruled by UN. That is a treason according to South Sudan Penal Code.
The United Nations Mission in South Sudan, or UNMISS for short, has a mandate of protecting civilians, facilitating humanitarian aid, and monitoring the human rights situation. Last week, the UN Security Council announced that it would be willing to send 4,000 extra troops to South Sudan. Its role, to provide a secure environment in and around Juba. In his response to the news, President Kiir carefully pointed out that he was not opposed to more UN troops. He, however, emphasized that South Sudan's sovereignty should not be compromised. Meanwhile, the United Nations Humanitarian Affairs Chief Stephen O'Brien concluded a visit to South Sudan, where he toured places accommodating people in dire need of humanitarian aid. He, however, failed to reach some areas on the outskirts of Juba due to the ongoing fighting. O'Brien voiced his disappointment in the security situation and what that meant for those in need of aid.
Under international humanitarian law and the other laws, it is actually our right to demand, as of right, access wherever humanitarian needs arise. We were told there were certain areas which were difficult because, of course, where there's conflict, that makes access very, very restricted, if not prohibited. And we have to make it clear that that is unacceptable from the humanitarian's point of view and that we have to demand the access.
O'Brien made it clear that the UN would continue to negotiate and make demands in order to reach those in need of humanitarian aid. Before leaving Juba, he had this message for the divided country.
My message for all the people in South Sudan is a military and a violent approach is not the solution and never can be and never will be. It can only create victims.
Already the violent clashes in South Sudan have, according to the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, forced more than 90,000 people to flee the country to seek refuge in neighboring nations of Kenya, Uganda, and the Democratic Republic of Congo.
James Shimanyula reporting. The island of Lamu off the Kenyan coast was once one of Kenya's major tourist attractions. But Lamu is close to war-torn Somalia, and there have been a number of terrorist raids and attacks on foreign visitors, which have been blamed on Somali militants. The tourists are now going elsewhere, but local residents are hoping they return one day to visit, among other things, Lamu Old Town, which is one of the UNESCO World Heritage List. This first installment in an occasional series on tourism in Africa was written by Linda Staud and is read by Samantha Ali.
A small sky blue motorboat ploughs its way through the waves. It is a water taxi on its way from the tiny airport of Lamu to the hotels in Shela village on the main island of the Lamu archipelago. The boat passes the picturesque seafront of the historic Lamu town. A dense mangrove forest grows on the other side of the waterway, and there are beautiful white sandy beaches. But only a handful of people enjoy the terrific view.
The people we are getting is like from Nairobi, from Mombasa, some Arab countries, but from Europe or some other places, nope.
Alham Mohammed is the manager of the Msafini Hotel on Lamu Island. Everything has been refurbished during Lamu's boom years. Abdullah Sultan, head tourist guide on Sheila Island, remembers those busy days very well.
You never can sit in the jetty more than half an hour to wait for tourism, because this was many.
But then in 2014, the Somalia-based Al-Shabaab militia attacked the small town of Mpeketoni on the Kenyan coast, killing more than 50 people. It takes an hour and a half by car and boat to get from Mpeketoni town to Lamu Island, but both are part of the same country. And that's why European countries, as well as the US, issued travel warnings. A disaster for the island of Lamu, says Nina Chauvel from Lamu's Tourism Association.
Even though nothing happened in the Lamu Islands, we live here, we feel safe, and we know that the government has put a lot of security measure in place and that the effort has been really made. Because we are here in one of the most beautiful archipelago, and we just feel like we should share this beauty with many others.
More than 3,000 donkeys carry goods or people, or they just walk about the narrow alleys between the old buildings with their famous elaborately carved doors. Lamu Old Town is the oldest and best preserved Swahili settlement in East Africa and a World Heritage Site of UNESCO. 75% of the islanders' income used to be generated from tourism. It's been very difficult for the islanders to cope since the majority of tourists has stopped coming. Fishing and a bit of agriculture are the only alternatives for jobless tour guides. Money is hard to come by, and poverty not only threatens the people, but also the island's rich cultural heritage, says Samia Omar Bwana, Lamu County's Minister for Trade and Tourism.
The less the community relies on tourism, the less they see what's the importance of this heritage site. If there's no direct monetary value, then how they make out their daily life is more important than the heritage.
For the moment, it is tourists from other parts of Kenya that keep the tourism industry on the island alive, just barely. Visitors from richer countries are not likely to return before the travel warnings are lifted.
A diamond is a diamond, and that's what Lamu is. So it's just a matter of time before you kind of dust it, polish it, and put it back.
That's why Umra Omar from the Tourism Association is optimistic that Lamu, the island that has seen 7 centuries of bustling international trade and cultural exchange, will thrive again and cater to visitors from around the world.
That report was written by Linda Staud.
Opinion.
We would like to hear your views on the Zambian elections. Zambian police said on Tuesday they had arrested more than 150 opposition demonstrators over protests that erupted after President Edgar Lungu was declared the winner of a highly contested vote. The opposition United Party for National Development, UPND, has rejected the vote as rigged and said it would formally challenge the result. What is your opinion on the Zambian elections? Were they free, fair and democratic? Do let us know your thoughts either in a brief SMS to country code 49160957 59510 and email to feedback.africa@dw.com or a letter to Africa Link DW53110 Bonn, Germany. And we'll read some of your comments right here on Africa Link in your feedback segment every Friday. Before we leave you now, a reminder of our main stories once again. More than 150 people have been arrested in Zambia following anti-government protests triggered by President Edgar Lungu's election victory. In South Africa, hundreds of miners and Marikana residents have been commemorating the victims of police killings 4 years ago. We've also been to the island of Lamu, where residents are hoping that one day the tourists will return. Do join us again tomorrow. This is Isaac Mugabe in Bonn, wishing you a splendid day ahead.